When we last left our heroes, they were locked into a terribly important discussion. Let's drop in on them again as they plot the future. Now, from the Top Dog's Kennel in beautiful downtown Burbank, it's the Terrence and Phillip Show.
Thank you very much, Gary. Once again, I love that open.
Indeed, indeed.
I'm Terrence Curran.
And I'm Phillip Hodgetts, and we are the Terrence and Phillip Show. But you knew that when you subscribed or started listening. Interesting, just recently, Netflix announced that they were going to get into original programming.
Yes.
Not for the first time.
But they have a series, a successful, potentially very successful series, and they've made a huge commitment. Usually you get 13 episode commitment, mm-hmm. if you're lucky. Generally, it's, you know, maybe five or six with the back other six or seven, you know, if the first ones are successful, et cetera. They made a commitment for 26 episodes, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's huge.
That is huge, particularly for an unproven series.
Yes.
But Netflix have one big advantage.
Which is
they know what their customers want to watch.
Yes.
And they know how popular the British version of this series has been amongst their customers. They retain all of that enormous amount of likes, preferreds, is similar to...
And an enormous database.
Enormous database. So they have an advantage over, say, a broadcast network who only has the broadest sort of demographics about their audience after the fact.
Yes, they're depending upon Nielsen to tell them what's going to work.
Yes, and that's
what worked.
And you've already spent on at least six or seven episodes before
right.
you ever find out if there's a demand for it.
Yes.
You can do the best guesses. Well, Netflix are not best guessing. Netflix have hard data that suggests they should have a better chance of success with this series through them.
So this is going to be a great experiment to see if that business model actually works.
Very much so.
I guarantee you there's going to be a lot of people watching.
I guarantee. Well, Hulu.
Apple, Hulu, yeah.
Hulu are also looking at the possibility of original programming. They've not quite as advanced as an announcement, but there have been rumors through the rumor mills in recent times that, indeed, Hulu are looking to distinguish themselves from their parent companies by paying for original programming.
So are we now looking at the new studios and the networks of the future?
We could well be. We could well be. And frankly, the Netflix model is quite attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything that's in their catalog, ideally, ultimately, when they get streaming rights organized,
mm-hmm.
streamed for a reasonable per month fee.
Right.
Now, they're not buying that series. They're only paying for first run and rerun rights. The other rights are still available to the producers to sell to other markets and for other purposes.
So they could still sell to a broadcaster, for instance.
They could, or sell on DVD or into
cable.
Into markets where Netflix doesn't reach internationally, for example,
mm-hmm.
to broadcasters or cable channels around the world where Netflix doesn't currently reach. So they have a diversified business model on that, but certainly the bulk of the money is coming from Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how the studios are treating Netflix, though. They're really starting to recognize that Netflix is a viable future alternative.
Yes, it is a threat.
And it's going to screw their business.
Yes.
So in turn, they are going to attempt to screw Netflix by starving it of content. Well, this is why Netflix are saying, well, let's not fall for that. Let's us create content. Well, I first wrote about this on my blog way too long ago. I've been going back over my blog and it's like, wow, I have been really writing some interesting stuff and not a bad prediction rate. So not perfect, but not bad
mm-hmm.
over the time. But yes, Apple or Google, either of them or together, could simply buy out all the programming from the people that have been traditionally producing. Now, House of Cards, the series that Netflix have purchased, is David Fisher.
Right.
It's an existing production
mm-hmm.
company. This is nothing really different for the production company. It's not a network, it's Netflix.
Right.
And it's a very small change, just work for Flix.
Right. Yeah, it's just who's signing the check.
Exactly. And so it doesn't have to be a broadcaster signing that check. If there's somebody who can aggregate the audience, then they can sign the check.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Apple could sign the check if the production companies or the studios don't want to play ball. If they say, no, you're streaming to the Apple TV or you're streaming Netflix is going to be too much of an impact. We're not going to let you have it until it's old and wasteland. Then you can have the content for, instead of the late night repeats. You can get it on Netflix. What the studios don't understand is that in doing that, they're becoming anti-customer. They're becoming anti their best interests long term. Right.
Then, well, this is not the first time.
You know. I think they have a history of doing it.
Yes.
Yeah, so
I still remember the fight against, you know, movies on VHS.
Yeah, indeed. And VHS, Betamax, and DVD subsequently is what has kept the industry in business. Scott Kersner has a book about just how Hollywood has reacted badly to technology through its entire history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're just seeing another reaction. It is going to change the dynamics, the financial dynamics, largely because we take out some of the middlemen. And to me, the Netflix model is much more attractive. I'd much more happily pay Netflix or Apple for the programming that I watch in a monthly subscription that's somewhat under $50.
Yeah.
Because that's what I can get 100 channels for with 160 hours of content per week if I want it.
Well, you still have to pay for however you're getting your internet subscription, however you're getting the bandwidth into your house. That's separate. I mean, Netflix is not a supplier, whereas your cable company is. They give you the bandwidth and they give you the cable.
Leaving an enormous conflict of interest for the cable company.
Yeah. Well, and net neutrality is what that's a whole other subject.
That's what we're hoping will prevent the companies from prioritizing their own services over everybody else's services, be they voice over IP or be they streamed content. But certainly, to me, that's a very attractive model, to be able to stream what I want, when I want, for a fair price.
Right.
And by fair price, I mean the sorts of money that a TV show generates for its broadcaster, which is rarely more than 65 cents per viewer per show at the high end. Yeah. Your hourly cost I worked out the numbers for a Super Bowl, it's something like 83 cents per viewer for the whole 3 hours.
Wow.
That's the cream. That's the big big profit day for whichever network carries that in any given year.
Yeah, I guarantee that the average is not that high.
No.
And when you start taking into account cable,
There's a lot of shows that I wouldn't pay 65 cents for.
Yeah, or ten cents.
I mean, see, I'd be happy.
I'd say pay 10 cents to not have it show up.
Yeah. Well, then what bugs me about cable is that I pay for cable. You know, I pay whoever, Charter or Dish Network or whatever, for cable, but then I still have to put up with ads.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's either or. Either I pay you or I get ads, and I would rather pay you and not get ads. Other people would prefer to get ads and not pay, and both models, I think, will continue to be viable.
So we have a future where Netflix and Apple and whatever, you know, other companies have become the main suppliers of programming, of quality programming, let's say, you know, as opposed to, you know, the average
YouTube
person throwing something on YouTube. Okay, so they become the main suppliers of that, and they're making their shows based on what people have watched and have liked in the past. Where does that leave us for innovation of new and different things? That's the downside I see to this. You know, if everything is based on predictability charts, you know, based on past viewing habits, then there's going to be no innovation.
Like there's innovation now.
Well, yeah, there is. You know, there's things that break out and then they do really well and then everybody copies them.
Yeah.
But the fact that somebody gets that chance to break out is because, you know, the networks and the cable stations will sit there and go, oh, we'll give you a chance with, you know, a pilot and we'll see how it does, you know. Whereas if everything is done by the numbers in the Netflix universe, well, people have, you know, people like this, so this is what we're going to make. Okay, well, maybe they might like something that they haven't seen before. How are you going to get that risk taken in that universe?
You would have to have somebody who was prepared to take risks occasionally for the sake of innovation. Although I still think that if you have the data warehouse that Netflix has, that you even with an unproven idea, you would have points where you could see where there are intersects with other composites of the idea or parallels to the innovative idea to get some sense of what will and will not work. But I don't know. I don't know the algorithm well enough. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they've got, what data they've got, and how you could predict from an unknown name. This current show is going to be really easy because there is a British series of essentially covering the same stories and same characters. So we have a direct parallel. Mm-hmm. And so that's the easiest low-hanging fruit to try and pick is making stuff that's like that. I always thought with my sort of new studio model that if one show ran its natural course and it had an audience, well, you simply rejig it with the same sorts of characters or the same sorts of stories and go again.
Well, yeah, that's
that's what television is
right
now.
That's what television is. How many versions of CSI are there?
Yes, you know? We're up against that. I don't know. It does run the risk of just creating mediocre and reproducing that same mediocrity or the same type of content all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe breakouts come first and then go into the system. It's kind of hard to tell how something's going to move forward when you've never seen it before, when we're in completely new territory. That's the hardest to predict at all.
Yes.
This isn't the first time that Netflix has started to disrupt. Netflix has already started to siphon off other markets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the original concept is, you know, the providing DVDs. That killed Blockbuster, basically. And then starting with the streaming.
Yes, but why did it kill Blockbuster? Let's go back to why Netflix was created in the first place. Because the guy who founded it got really annoyed at a late charge when
yes.
he returned something
yeah.
to Blockbuster or one of the other DVD rental companies.
Right.
Saying, basically, this is not customer-friendly.
Yeah. But then again, you know, Netflix is not above and beyond it all either. You know, they've been accused of intentionally slowing down the turnaround times on DVDs for heavy users.
Yes, yeah. They have. And I think they have addressed that. They were certainly accused of that, and there was some evidence, but I haven't heard that of recent times. That's really – it could have also been part of their growing pains. The DVD rental business grew really, really fast and almost exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there was a period when they had to slow things down just a bit so that they could ensure a bit more fairness to everybody. This is, of course, the net neutrality argument again from the cable company side.
Right.
But if a film's been on Netflix, it tends to not sell overseas as well. And if a film's not available on Netflix, it tends to...
Why is that?
Because Netflix takes the scarcity out of the equation. And they can watch them anytime commercial-free. Well, if you're watching a movie on a foreign TV station with commercials, it's less attractive than streaming it. Although Netflix is...
Oh, from the streaming standpoint. Okay.
Yeah.
I was still thinking of the DVDs, and I'm going, how would that work?
No, okay, the DVD side of the Netflix business, while still growing, is expected to diminish by 2015.
Yeah,
so
okay.
They expect that by 2015 they'll be doing the majority of their business in streaming, and it's certainly the streaming side that they are looking to build right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing is that Netflix is quite long-tail friendly in terms of their DVD side, and their streaming side tends to be long-tail, although looking at it just recently, I was very pleasantly surprised as to how much of the television that I watch is available through Netflix.
Oh, okay.
Because I tend to watch a lot of British television.
Okay.
Stuff I grew up with. I first contacted in Australia.
So.
And a lot of that is available through Netflix, through streaming. So this becomes a much more attractive proposition.
I didn't even think about the TV side of it because I mostly watch movies. I prefer waiting for the DVD. I mean, the DVD quality is superior to the streaming quality off of Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, bandwidth again. But
and Blu-ray even more so.
Yes, exactly. There is still a market there for that. You know, the other part is a lot of movies that I want to see, they don't have a streaming version. They only have the DVD version.
Well, it's, again, licensing issues. And,
right.
And there's the right of first sale doctrine that allows the studios to not really have any control over what happens to the DVDs other than that what Netflix wants to give them. And such as like, they've tried to block Netflix from buying DVDs for 28 days after the release for sale and things like that. Which do fly in the face of the first sale doctrine, which is that once I buy something, it's mine, which applies to physical goods. But if I buy that same content online, it's a license, not a physical product that I can sell. There's a double standard here. Is it property or is it not property? If it's property, then it's mine and I can sell it. If it's not property, then you don't have any claim for intellectual property theft because it's not property. And intellectual property is not property. But that's a whole other discussion.
I should know better than to get Philip going on that. Okay, so back to Netflix. You know, one of the problems that I see with Netflix is that they're not very independent filmmaker friendly. It's relatively difficult to get a movie into their universe.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's actually very hard.
That's interesting because that's quite contrary to their stated goal of having a copy of every DVD that's ever produced in their library.
I know what their stated goal is. I'm just telling you.
Okay.
And it is difficult. If you don't believe me, go online and search for how do I submit my movie to Netflix and find out just how difficult it becomes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. It's along the lines of maybe worse than iTunes. You know, where iTunes you have two companies that you have to go through if you want to get to iTunes because there's only two, I believe, that do it all. the final steps of it, yeah, and it's submitting to them. So even though there's a lot of other companies that say, yeah, we can get your movie on there, ultimately they're using one of those two companies.
Yes.
So it's interesting. It's not as open as you might think it was, is, but
– or you might hope.
Or might hope, yes.
But it is definitely an indicator of the direction we're going, that other people can write the check.
Yes.
It really is a matter of, can I aggregate an audience,
mm-hmm.
and can I get a return on my investment? In fact, might have an NAB in-depth session on this very same thing. So if you're at NAB on Wednesday the 13th of April and you want to go into and get into the post-production conference, I have an in-depth session on how to grow an audience and monetize them for your independent project. And part of that point is you've got to go into it thinking of it as being a business.
Absolutely.
My starting slide shows that the traditional independent production model has been, I'll make it and then I'll find a market.
Yes, exactly.
And frankly, you would be better off taking the money you had and going to Vegas and gambling it, because the odds are significantly better of a return, because at least something like 85% goes back in Vegas. Whereas very, very, very few independent films or
make 85% back. No, yeah.
Most rare.
Most
make something like nothing back.
Yes.
2,000 films get submitted to Sundance any given year. 200 or less get into competition. I don't know what the numbers are for competition. It's probably lower than 200.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
And even this last bumper year, we're seeing about 5 or 6 big deals coming out of Sundance. But the year before, there were none. Or there was one. The chances of coming out of Sundance with a distribution deal is still very low, even if you're in competition, let alone if you're just submitting.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to those other 1,800 movies that don't get into it Netflix?
Well, a lot of them eventually lose interest. Some of them get a distributor who, you know, says, oh, I'll take care of you, and gives them nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's it is a very difficult market. And people who, you know, as you say, people who go into it making the movie thinking, well, I'll, you know, once I've got it, I'll be able to sell it, are not – they're in for a rude surprise. You're better off making a trailer.
Mm.
Just shoot a trailer as if you made the movie and then go around and try to sell it.
Because one of the interesting statistics I heard, and I haven't been able to personally verify it, but that you can get a better deal in a documentary sale if you do the deal before you make it. Than you have if you have a finished documentary and then are trying to sell it.
Well, yeah, because they have you by the cojones at that point, yes.
Exactly. And so you really don't want to do the whole deal until you've got the whole package. What the session will go through, though, is a little bit on there are other ways of building an audience than spending $20 million on billboards and television advertising.
Right.
And there are other ways of monetizing than simply selling the DVD or an online stream. There are many ways, because you've got to monetize scarcity, not infinite availability, because economics says that when the cost of production is zero, that's exactly how much you can get for it.
Mm-hmm.
And a digital copy has so close to cost of production of zero that ultimately everything tends towards the incremental cost and not taking into account the original production cost. But those people who have been very successful in the new model have found ways of connecting with their audiences and then finding something to sell the audience.
Right.
And Kickstarter-type crowdfunded projects are starting to become more popular too. They're starting to get some momentum, not in huge budgets,
mm-hmm.
but in decent-sized budgets.
When you say decent-sized budgets, what are we talking about?
Up to $100,000.
For a feature or a show?
No, for a show.
Okay.
And a short film.
Okay.
Some people are only really looking for $5,000. Some people are looking for more. And it's not just film projects. The GILF. I've always got to be thinking careful about how I say that, which is a little adapter for an iPhone 4 to put it onto a tripod or to hold it at an angle to view. They were looking for, I think, $10,000 to buy or have their mold
mm-hmm.
made after they'd proofed it with 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
And they got over $200,000 within days.
Wow.
Of crowdfunding, which, of course, meant that they could move forward so much faster in their marketing efforts and their distribution efforts. And it's a great little tool. And people saw the potential of it, but...
Have they made their $200,000 back?
I don't know that. The idea with crowdsourcing is that you provide some benefit if the project goes ahead.
Right.
Then those people who are contributing get some benefit in advance.
The original concept of the stock market.
Yeah, yeah. So we may see funding models that don't necessarily involve one person writing a check.
Mm-hmm.
But we would need these models to be more established and more proven, more provable, before
yes.
we get the bridging loan that allows us to create it, even if we know we can get a return, you know, we've got all of the history, all of the numbers say, yes, we know exactly how to get a return out of this, but nobody will finance that hump that you've got to pay before you start to get. And that's what the crowdsourcing is designed to control, is that hump. How do you get around? How do you get enough to get it made? Not just live while you get it made and then hope to get the, or work on getting the return later.
So, in closing, once again, the Netflix model has now thrown another layer of disturbance in the business model that we are all used to. Very predictable. You and I have been talking about this stuff coming for years.
Yes.
It's one more step in the long-range game. But my big concern, as I've said, is that how does it limit creativity and innovation?
Yes. Are we replacing one set of gatekeepers with another set of gatekeepers
yes.
that are equally hard to deal with?
Right.
And I keep hoping that we're not. I keep fearing that we will.
Yes. I mean, it seems, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Indeed. Indeed.
But if you have shot a film and you're looking to make it look and sound better, or you need help with distribution or delivery, come to alphadogs.tv. That's what we do. Or digitalservicestation.com, which you can find in a location near you, which will help with your delivery requirements wherever you manage to have landed your project.
Indeed. And if you want to hear more of my rantings or thoughts, check out my blog at philiphodgetts.com. I tend to do my experimental thinking there. And if you go back to 2005, 6, and 7 and check it out, you can see that I had some of these ideas written down way back then as to, for example, what role is left for the studios. I was reading over the weekend some of my old work. And indeed, it's kind of what we're talking about now. Other people can write the checks. And if you do have a production underway and you want to take out the boring parts, check out assistedediting.com, a combination of great utilities to take out the boring and some really groundbreaking workflow tools like Predit. If you're working in documentaries and you use transcriptions, you can use Predit now. Get all the benefits of working with the text and cutting so much faster. So that's at assistedediting.com and philiphodgetts.com.
Thanks for listening.
And don't forget to go over to theterrenceandphillipshow.com and comment, because we'd like to know what you think about what we say, whether you agree with us or whether you don't. Just be sure to have a thought-through opinion.